KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I don't see how you can undercurrent infrastructure investment plans. You could possibly achieve those net zero goals.
The boom in AI has caused a surge in carbon emissions and water consumption. So what are big tech companies doing about it? For Sunday, March 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. Coming up, America is aging. In a few years, people over 65 will outnumber those under 18. That's led to a growing number of people caring for those with Alzheimer's and dementia.
It's a moving target. You think you've adjusted, and then the disease progresses, and you've lost another piece.
We'll meet the groundskeepers preparing Baltimore's baseball stadium for another season, and hear from author Layla Lalami about her new sci-fi novel, The Dream Hotel.
Sometimes we accept so much of that surveillance into our lives and don't question the end result of it.
First, news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump isn't ruling out seeking a third term in the White House, despite the U.S. Constitution blocking another run. During a phone interview with NBC News, Trump said he's, quote, not joking. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
The Constitution's 22nd Amendment says no one can be elected president more than twice. Yet Trump tells NBC News, quote, there are methods. The president says one way is for the vice president, J.D. Vance, to run at the top of the ticket and then hand the presidency over to Trump. But the 12th Amendment says a vice presidential candidate must be eligible for president. Trump says there are other methods, but he didn't elaborate. During his phone interview, Trump didn't mention the Constitution, but he did mention his popularity. Quote, a lot of people would like me to do that. End quote. Trump said it's too early to decide whether he'll run again or endorse Vance. Some ardent Trump allies have encouraged a third term. That includes Republican Congressman Andy Ogles, who proposed amending the 22nd Amendment. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is defying an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court by traveling to Hungary this week. The ICC has accused him of war crimes in Gaza. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said that he will travel to Hungary this week to meet Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Orban is a right-wing populist and announced that he would disregard the International Criminal Court arrest warrant against Netanyahu back when it was issued in November. The ICC has accused Netanyahu, his former defense minister, and Hamas's former military chief of crimes against humanity in the war in Gaza. Israel has denied the charges. Some countries in the European Union, including Hungary, are members of the ICC and are expected to enforce warrants. Hungary will be Netanyahu's second foreign trip since the ICC warrant was announced. The first was to Washington, D.C. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News.
This is NPR. The death toll from Friday's devastating earthquake in the Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar is expected to climb much higher after topping 1,600. Michael Sullivan has more.
2 days after the 7.7 magnitude quake struck, rescue workers are frantically digging through the rubble, some by hand, to find survivors. Many rescuers complaining of a lack of heavy equipment and personnel as the smell of death begins to hang over parts of the city. Mandalay's airport remains closed, hampering relief efforts, with the UN warning of a severe shortage of medical supplies in a country whose public health system was already in tatters after 4 years of civil war following the 2021 coup. Myanmar's insular military rulers are allowing some aid in, with China and India the first to send supplies. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A trial gets underway tomorrow over who should pay the damages caused by a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio in 2023. Toxic chemicals spilled and caught fire. Norfolk Southern Railroad had agreed to pay the $600 million settlement, but it wants two other companies to contribute, saying rail car owner GATX and the chemical manufacturer OxyVinyls are also partly responsible. Residents, though, are still waiting to get most of the money from the settlement because of pending appeals. A new baseball bat has been hitting quite a few home runs this weekend. The New York Yankees scored 9 home runs in their second game of the season, and some are speculating it has to do with this new bat that's being used by some of the players. NPR's Mansi Khanna has more.
The torpedo bat has a larger barrel than most bats, which gives the hitter a greater amount of surface area to hit the ball with. The Yankees tied its record for most home runs in Saturday's game against the Milwaukee Brewers. 5 of the home runs were scored using the bat, according to ESPN. The Yankees won the game 20-9. A spokesperson for Major League Baseball has said the bat does meet the league standards. And it was used again in Sunday's game against the Brewers, which the Yankees won 12-3. Monty Crana, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures down about 0.4%. NASDAQ futures are down 1%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Emily Kwong in for Scott Detrow. Perhaps you have played around with artificial intelligence or have seen AI woven into your favorite apps. AI infrastructure is a big priority under the Trump administration, and tech companies are investing heavily. It's an exciting field, one that captured Sasha Lucioni. In 2018, she started a new job, AI researcher at Morgan Stanley. She was excited to learn something new in the field of AI, but couldn't shake this worry.
I essentially was getting more and more climate anxiety. I was really feeling this profound disconnect between my job and my values and the things that I cared about. And so essentially I was like, oh, I should quit my job and go plant trees. I should do something that's really making a difference in the world. And then my partner was like, well, you have a PhD in AI, maybe you can use that to make a difference in the world.
So Lucioni quit her job and joined a growing movement to make AI more sustainable. Since 2022, AI has boomed and it's caused a surge in energy consumption. Tech companies are racing to build data centers to keep up, these huge buildings filled with hundreds of thousands of computers that require a lot of energy. By 2028, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory forecasts that data centers could consume as much as 12% of the nation's electricity. And AI is also leading a surge in water consumption. It's a concern echoed all over social media.
The amount of water that AI uses is astonishing.
AI needs water.
People are saying that every time you use ChatGPT,
ChatGPT uses this much water for a 100-word email.
And where will that water come from?
And the four big data center operators with a growing water and carbon footprint are Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta. And to be clear, all four of those are among NPR's financial supporters and pay to distribute some of our content.
Before generative AI came along in late 2022, there was hope among these data center operators that they could go to net zero.
Benjamin Lee studies computer architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. Generative AI refers to the AI that uses large language models.
So I don't see how you can, under current infrastructure investment plans, you could possibly achieve those net zero goals.
And data center construction is only going to increase. On January 21st, the day after his second inauguration, President Trump announced a private joint venture to build 20 large data centers across the country, as heard here on NBC.
A new American company that will invest $500 billion at least in AI infrastructure in the United States and very, very quickly, moving very rapidly.
This new project, known as Stargate, would together consume 15 gigawatts of power. That would be like 15 new Philadelphia-sized cities consuming energy. So how is the industry thinking about its future and its environmental footprint? The four cloud giants, Google, Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon, all have climate goals, goals for hitting net zero carbon emissions, most by 2030, Amazon by 2040. And there's a few ways they can get there. Let's start with a very popular energy source for big tech, nuclear. Because Amazon, Meta, and Alphabet, which runs Google, just signed an agreement, along with other companies, that supports tripling the global nuclear supply by 2050. And along with Microsoft, these four companies have signed agreements to purchase nuclear energy, an industry that has been stagnant for years. Microsoft has committed to buying power from an old nuclear plant on Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. You may remember that was the site of a partial nuclear meltdown in 1979. And NPR's Nina Totenberg talked to kids in the Harrisburg area right after.
You know what evacuation is?
That everybody has to go.
Do you know why?
Because of radioactivity.
While some radioactive gas was released, thankfully, it wasn't enough to cause serious health effects. And Microsoft now wants to build this nuclear site back. In a way, AI companies are turning into energy brokers. But my science desk colleague, Jeff Brumfield, sees a discrepancy in this between the AI people and the nuclear energy people.
These are just two super different engineering cultures. You know, and the way I've come to think about it is Silicon Valley loves to go fast and break things. The nuclear industry has to move very, very, very slowly because nothing can ever break.
Because of accidents like Three Mile Island, Jeff says that nothing in the nuclear industry ever happens quickly. It's also extremely expensive. And while solar and wind energy combined with batteries is quicker to build and more inexpensive than nuclear or gas power plants, it still takes time to build, and there are problems hooking up new energy sources to the grid. So in the meantime, many data centers will continue to use fossil fuels. But there's another solution here, and that's to make data centers themselves more efficient through better hardware, better chips, and more efficient cooling systems. One of the most innovative methods on the rise is liquid cooling. Basically, running a synthetic fluid through the hottest parts of the server to take the heat away, or immersing whole servers in a cool bath. It's the same idea as running coolant through your car engine, and a much faster way to cool off a hot computer. Here's Benjamin Lee again at UPenn.
And as you can imagine, it's much more efficient because now you're just cooling the surface of whatever the cold plate is covering rather than just blowing air through the entire machine.
One of the biggest providers of liquid cooling is Isotope. David Craig is their recently retired CEO and based in the UK.
I definitely come from the point of view that, you know, we literally have just one planet, and I cannot understand why anybody would want to do anything other than care for it.
Craig says that the older way of cooling data centers, basically, there's lots of methods, but it's a daisy chain of moving heat with air and water, is consumptive. With liquid cooling, a lot of the heat stays in the system, and computers don't have these massive swings in temperature.
It's not got a constant thermal shock. It's got less vibration from fans and stuff like that, so things last longer. And then what we're doing is we're capturing that heat in a closed water loop.
Liquid cooling, however, is expensive, which makes it hard to scale. But Isotope has announced public partnerships with Hewlett-Packard and Intel, and a spokesperson at Meta told me they anticipate some of the company's liquid cooling-enabled data centers will be up and running by 2026. Throughout my many emails and 7 hours of phone conversations with spokespersons at Amazon, Google, and Microsoft too, there was one innovation they were kind of quiet about, and it's the one that scientists and engineers outside of big tech were most excited about. And that is smaller AI models. One's good enough to complete a lot of the tasks we care about, but in a much less energy-intensive way. Basically, a third and final solution to AI's climate problem is using less AI. One major disruptor in this space is DeepSeek, the chatbot out of a company in China claiming to use less energy. We reached out to them for comment, but they did not reply. You see, large language models like ChatGPT often trained using large data sets, say by feeding the model over a million hours of YouTube content. But DeepSeek was trained by data from other language models. Benjamin Lee at UPenn says this is called a mixture of experts.
The whole idea behind a mixture of experts is you don't need a single huge model with a trillion parameters to answer every possible question under the sun. Rather, you would like to have a collection of experts, smaller models, and then you just sort of route the request to the right expert. And because each expert is so much smaller, it's going to cost less energy to invoke.
Even though DeepSeek was trained more efficiently this way, other scientists I spoke to pointed out it's still a big model.
and Sasha Lucioni at Hugging Face wants to walk away from those entirely.
Since ChatGPT came out, people were like, oh, we want general purpose models. We want models that can do everything at once, answer questions, and write recipes and poetry and whatever. But nowadays, more and more, I think companies especially are like, well, actually, for our intents and purposes, we want to do X, like whatever, summarize PDFs.
What Sasha is talking about are small language models, which have far fewer parameters and are trained for a specific task. And some tech companies are experimenting with this. Last year, Meta announced a smaller quantized version of some of their models. Microsoft announced a family of small models called Phi-3. A spokesperson for Amazon said they're open to considering a number of models that can meet their customers' needs. And a spokesperson for Google said they did not have a comment about small language models at this time. So meanwhile, the race to build infrastructure for large language models is very much underway. Here's Kevin Miller, who runs global infrastructure at Amazon Web Services.
I think you have to look at the world around us and say, we're moving towards a more digital economy overall, and that is ultimately kind of the biggest driver for the need for data centers and cloud computing.
If that is the level of computing we're headed for, Lucioni has one last idea, an industry-wide score for AI models. Just like Energy Star became a widely recognized program for ranking the energy efficiency of appliances. She says that tech companies, however, are far from embracing something similar.
So we're having a lot of trouble getting buy-in from companies. There's like such a blanket ban on any kind of transparency because it could either like make you look bad, open you up for whatever legal action, or just kind of give people a sneak peek behind the curtain.
So as a science reporter for NPR, my main question is, do we really need all of this computing power when we know it could imperil climate goals? And David Craig, the recently retired CEO of Isotope, chuckled when I asked this. He said, Emily, you know, human nature is against us.
We are always that kid who does touch the very hot ring on the cooker when our mum said don't, you know. We are always the people who touch the wet paint sign and stuff, right? That's human beings. And the truth is with data, you know, this stuff has just grown up in the background. People just haven't known about it.
But here's something I think we can all think about. The AI revolution is still fairly new. Google CEO Sundar Pichai compared AI to the discovery of electricity. Except unlike the people during the Industrial Revolution, we know AI has a big climate cost, and there's still time to adjust how and how much of it we use. You can hear more science reporting like this on the science podcast I co-host every week, Shortwave. Check it out. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. People are looking for survivors in the rubble in Myanmar, often digging by hand, after a magnitude 7.7 earthquake on Friday. More than 1,600 people died, and officials expect that number to rise. Thousands are injured. This as rebel groups say the military government is continuing airstrikes in that country's civil war. President Trump says he's not ruling out a third term. NBC News reports in a phone interview Trump said he's not joking and that there are methods for doing so. But under the Constitution's 22nd Amendment, no one can be elected president more than twice. And actor Richard Chamberlain has died. He starred in the popular TV medical drama Dr. Kildare in the 1960s and later starred in the miniseries including Shogun and The Thornbirds. He was 90 years old. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. Do you remember your dreams? I don't, but in The Dream Hotel, a new book by Pulitzer finalist Leila Lalami, dreams are surveilled through special implants designed to help people get a good night of sleep, but that data is also sold to the government, and the results are life-altering. Leila Lalami joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about the character who's at the heart of the Dream Hotel. How did she come to you? And what is the world she's living in?
Right. So my character's name is Sara Hussein. She's a historian by training, but she works for the Getty Museum as an archivist. She's a very busy mom of twin toddlers, and she has what is, by all accounts, a very ordinary life. And then one day, she's returning home from a conference abroad when she is pulled aside because her dreams indicate that she will soon commit a crime.
Her actual, so this, while she's asleep, dreams.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. And so the character came to me a few years ago. I had written a version of this book that took place in a tech company, and it wasn't going anywhere. But then one day I had this idea of this woman stepping out of her room, having this implant that gets checked by this mysterious attendant to make sure she hasn't tampered with it. And I kind of just followed that character page by page and Whoa. Got to know her a little bit, got to know her relationship with her family, with her husband, with her children, the kind of life she had, and how everything sort of unravels through this encounter with agents from the Risk Assessment Administration. Yeah. So it was great fun to kind of get to follow her as she comes face to face with the surveillance state.
And you're very careful to write that the women at the center of this book are being retained, not mm-hmm. detained. What is the difference and why is it relevant to your story?
Yeah, so again, because this book investigates the world of dreams, the most private part of ourselves, and looks at what might happen when data collection penetrates it, we're now, you know, firmly in the territory of intentions, right? Where people might get, I don't know, you know, apprehended on a street because of, you know, speech crimes or thought crimes. We're already at that level. So mm-hmm. it seemed the next level would be, you know, what if it is this world of the imagination?
And was that inspired by your own dreaming or how did that come to you? Did you have a dream about this book? I don't know.
No. It came to me because I had overslept one morning uh-huh. and I reached for my phone first thing to look at the time. And I saw a Google notification that said, if you leave right now, you will make it to the name of my yoga studio at 7:28. And uh-huh. I had never told, you know, obviously Google what day of the week or what time of day or even that I went to yoga, but obviously yeah. the company had followed my movements and learned my habits. And so I was understandably disturbed by that. I think by design, surveillance technology is meant to be invisible. Yes, we know that our devices collect data about us, but all of that data collection is meant to be seamless and invisible. And that Google notification was kind of a moment where the curtains parted and I got a glimpse of just how granular the data that they collect can be. And I remember I turned to my husband and I said, you know, pretty soon the only privacy any of us will have left will be in our dreams. And of course, being a novelist, I thought, well, wait, what if someday that actually does happen, that we continue on this trend of using technologies for every single thing that we do? Why not, you know, sleep aids that help you sleep, but also collect data about you in your sleep?
So there's just this bit of writing from the book that I can't stop thinking about. It's page 306. You write, Sarah, she wants to be free. And what is freedom if not resting of the self from the gaze of others, including her own? Life is meant to be lived, to be seized for all the beauty and joy to be wrung out of it. It isn't meant to be contained and inventoried for the sake of safety. Now that this book is out in the world, what do you want people to take away from that message?
Well, I think what I would want, first of all, is for people to just be moved by this character and her journey from this person who feels herself to be at a remove from this surveillance state to a person who's very much implicated in it and by it, to be moved by that journey, to feel that if a character like that can manage to find a way out, then surely we too have the power to figure out our own ways to freedom. And I think, you know, particularly because this is a book about surveillance, to have it be a warning. You know, sometimes we accept so much of that surveillance into our lives and don't question the end result of it, you know, where this is all going, what it is doing to our relationships, what it is doing to our society, and most importantly, what it's doing to our sense of selves. If you are continually behaving in certain ways because you're trying to avoid, I don't know, you know, having comments from strangers online, or you're trying to avoid the gaze of the camera, or you're trying to avoid, you know, then you have lost your sense of freedom.
Yeah. Have you yourself changed how you live and your relationship to technology since writing this book?
This is the question that has come up so much during the...
Clearly on everyone's minds.
Yes. I would say that I have spent the last 10 years thinking about this book. I actually started writing it in 2014. So I've been thinking about technology very carefully over the last 10 years. And it has been very sobering to watch how it has woven itself into every part of our lives. And it is true that I have begun the process of trying to untether myself from as many of these apps as possible. So I've been on a journey to kind of remove, you know, I take it as a challenge. I try to live with as few of them as possible. But also I'm now, my new thing that I've begun doing is to try to reduce the amount of time I spend online at all, you know, to decrease it. Life is meant to be lived offline.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you through good old-fashioned conversation.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Layla Lalami, Dream Hotel is available now wherever books are sold.
Thank you so much for having me.
Call it a silver tsunami or just going gray. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that in just 10 years, older adults will outnumber those under 18 for the first time in U.S. history. America is aging, and that means more families providing care for parents and grandparents and even great-great-grandparents. And while much has already been said about caregiving, there is far less research into what it's like to walk that road alone. To talk about solo caregiving and more, we called Marie Kluker. Kluker is a clinical social worker specializing in older adults and family work at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about this phenomenon, because I imagine a lot of NPR listeners are in this situation, are the sole caregivers of people they love. So can you talk about what are the mental and physical day-to-day realities of that?
The day-to-day is you're not only caring for yourself, but also keeping up with appointments, creating a social calendar, making sure meds are correct. You're running two people's lives,
yeah,
but you're only one person. And this is also a significant role shift for everyone, whether it's a spouse caregiver who based their life with this other person as mutually coming to decisions of someone who cared when you said, you know, I really need a haircut, and they actually listened to you. And now you're holding all of that with no one to share it, or a child who's caring for a parent where the roles are now reversed. And this is a huge disorientation for caregivers.
Yeah. Just briefly, what additional challenges do single caregivers face when taking care of those who have dementia or Alzheimer's or another cognitive disease?
People who care for someone with dementia, the hours are much more. And this has a physical and emotional toll on folks, where the, you know, dementia caregivers have 40% higher odds of increasing in frailty, chronic diseases like diabetes, even increased odds of cancer, decreased mobility, and then higher levels of depression and anxiety. And the toll is, you know, in part because dementia can be such a long disease, but it's also what they call the long goodbye. You're losing a piece of a person at a time as their abilities change. And so it's a moving target. You think you've adjusted, and then the disease progresses and you've lost another piece.
And so where can people turn to for help in that situation, both among their family and friends, and also when it comes to groups or services?
There are aging service access points or area agencies on aging called AAAs or ASAP ASAPs. And so these coordinate and offer services that help older adults remain in their homes, get some home care, meals on wheels, homemaker assistance. Some of them would be private pay, things like home care agencies or home health aid may be able to come in. Depending on one's financial situation, sometimes these can be covered by, say, Medicaid.
And I imagine having stronger social connections makes a big difference in having just contingency plans. You know, should something happen to you as a caregiver, knowing there's a wider community out there to check in on your person is important.
It sure does make a difference. It is both important for the caregiver to cultivate social connection, but I also think about what is our responsibility as a society. When caregivers are supported in the ways that help them to draw out those deep values that keep them, maybe started them caregiving and keep them caregiving, things like loyalty, feelings of integrity, selflessness, the closeness and connection of caregiving and of inviting other people into their lives to share through help actually yields people who have become more flexible, more tender, more gracious, and more connected. If we can imagine that help for caregivers would support even a fraction of the 53 million caregivers that we have in the US to emerge as that more generous, gentle, connected people, can you imagine how that will change our society? And I think that this is the invitation to our generation to care for our older adults and to care for their caregivers.
Marie Kluker is a clinical social worker specializing in older adults and family work at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So far in his second term, President Trump has signed more than 100 executive orders. Critics say it's Trump's attempt to expand presidential power, but how did the framers of the Constitution think about the executive branch?
Half the time, they're worried about making this office too strong. The other half, they're worried about making it too weak. It's kind of like Goldilocks, right? They want to make it just right.
The team at NPR's podcast Throughline explores that history. Hear what they found tomorrow on All Things Considered. And there's so many ways to listen online on your phone, the radio, or your smart speaker. Just ask for NPR or your local member station by name. This is NPR. Major League Baseball stadiums all over the country are hosting their first games of the season this week. But it's not just the players making their debut. Oh no, the fields take months to prepare to ensure they're in top shape to wow audiences and minimize injury. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR takes us to Baltimore to see how the Orioles prepare for their home opener.
Orioles groundskeeper Nicole Sherry is tamping dirt at home plate.
We built all this back up from scratch. Not the entire plate, but just, you know, this rim area.
Yeah.
And that's all we've been doing is tamp. So, wow. A little bit exhausted.
For the better part of a week, Sherry's crew's been tamping dirt by hand with flattening tools to ensure the home plate mound at Camden Yards is at a certain elevation and gradient for baseball and for water runoff. The work's all part of a month-long sprint the Orioles grounds crew goes through every spring to ensure the field's in tip-top shape for its TV appearances and for the players who will be running and fielding balls on it.
The main importance of keeping a safe and healthy playing surface is for the athletes that play here. You know, if we don't have a good root system or a good strong grass plant that can withstand the impact from the soles of their feet or their diving for a ball, you know, that could in turn cause an injury.
A divot in the dirt could be the difference between a hurried run to first base and a torn ACL or an errant ball bounce to the face. So, as spring nears, it's all hands on deck to get the grass growing in green, the dirt smooth, and the chalk lines fresh.
Everything's starting to wake up, so we're trying to cut, we're trying to get the grass stimulated and growing.
Andrew Lawling is the Orioles' assistant director of field operations.
We take field data every single day. We're measuring the moisture, we're measuring the soil temp, the canopy temp, and all the environmental factors that play part of how to grow grass or anything really.
Once things are growing, the team focuses on maintenance and cosmetics. That's the sound of heavy-duty mowers the team uses to give the grass that fresh checkered look you see on television. But the chance of a wild pitch from Mother Nature is always present. Sherry keeps a Doppler weather radar screen up in her office, and for opening day, the forecast is looking questionable. The Orioles have a crew of about 30 people on call to do groundskeeping tasks during games. They're the ones who pull a gigantic tarp over the diamond at the chance of rain, an important job to protect the field during storms so players can get back on the field quickly. Nathan Shiflett is one of the grounds crew members.
It's unreal. I feel like it's a dream come true because I always dreamed of being a baseball player for the Orioles when I was younger. And now I get the next best thing is be on that field taking care of them, make sure it's all good for them to go. Looking good.
The Orioles are a hyped-up team with loads of young talent, and Nicole Sherry, a 22-year veteran at the stadium, is only one of two women to ever serve as a Major League Baseball groundskeeper.
For the fans, like you see this field and you're like, wow, this is amazing looking, you know. I could see all the wrong in it. I could see all the little things that, you know, are imperfect, but I think for any fan that comes to the field or watches it on TV, you know, they marvel at this, you know, ballpark and they marvel at the field.
The Baltimore Orioles hold their first home game against the Boston Red Sox on Monday. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
This is NPR News.
Tesla has seen a drop in global sales and stock prices for a while. According to a longtime brand and marketing consultant, Elon Musk's politics are only part of the problem.
It's his lack of focus and interest in a car company
which has been demonstrated by lack of innovation and his attention going everywhere but the car company.
That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump this week is set to impose major new tariffs on cars and auto parts made outside the U.S., which is expected to raise prices. Trump hopes to boost domestic manufacturing, although cars made in the U.S. often contain parts made in other countries. A trial gets underway tomorrow to determine who will pay a $600 million settlement from the Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, 2 years ago. The railroad is trying to force a transportation company and a chemical manufacturer to share the cost. And Major League Baseball says a new bat used by the Yankees is legal. It was designed to bring more mass to where the hitters most often make contact. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. John Green is prolific. He has written best-selling young adult novels like The Fault in Our Stars, Turtles All the Way Down, and built a YouTube empire with his brother, Hank Green, through the Vlog Brothers channel, which pretty much got me through high school. John Green's newest project is a nonfiction book called Everything is Tuberculosis, an account of why TB remains such a deadly disease. And you can see a common thread in all of these projects. They are all designed to help people engage with the broader world and to care for each other. Green spoke with my colleague Rachel Martin on the Wildcard podcast, where guests answer big questions about their life drawn from a deck of cards.
Okay, three cards in my hand. One, two, or three?
Let's go one.
One. Do you spend more time in your head or in the world?
It's not a particularly close competition there, Rachel. I spend more time in my head by a very wide margin.
What's it like in there?
Pretty intense, to be honest with you. A little overwhelming sometimes. I almost can't say what it's like in there. It's like trying to describe the ocean to somebody who's never seen it, you know? Like, mm-hmm. It's... what did Kafka say, that a book can be the axe that breaks the frozen sea within? I'm always trying to break that frozen sea within. There's always rooms inside of my mind that I've never visited or I don't know how to get to. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of why I make creative work, is because it's a chance to visit those rooms somehow, a chance to feel my understanding of my own self expand in some ways. But I spend a lot of time in my head, and not all of it is healthy, if I'm honest with you. Like,
well, you've been open about that, about talking about your OCD.
Yeah, I have pretty severe OCD, and so it's well treated, and I work really hard to treat my chronic illness like a chronic illness, but it is a chronic illness, and it is something I live with every day. And so sometimes what's in my head is just like a flurry of worries. There's this great Edna St. Vincent Millay poem I think about all the time, where she says, I think she's writing about depression more than obsessive thoughts, but I think it's the perfect summary of obsessive thoughts. She says, she's writing about a snowstorm, and she says, three flakes, then four appear, then many more. And it's like that with my worries sometimes, mm-hmm. where it's like, you just have a worry that kind of crosses crosses across your bow, and then another one, and then another one, and then many more. And it becomes like a snowstorm, just absolutely blinding, impossible to see anything other than the fear. And that's a really difficult, really scary experience, because then it feels like you're not in control of your own thoughts. Like you're not the captain of the ship of yourself. You're just along for the ride and somebody else is steering the ship. And that's quite a scary thing to think about your own self.
Is there anything positive about it? Is there anything beneficial about it besides the fact that it is who you are? But
yeah, it is who I am. I mean, I find it to be mostly downsides, okay, to be honest with you. Mostly bummers. And so it's hard to, of course, I don't know what I would be like without OCD. And so I can't imagine what it would be, but I'm sure I would be different in ways I can't imagine now.
Yeah, it is who you are.
Yeah, I like that way of saying it, but that like there is an upside, but the upside is that it is who I am.
Yeah,
I've never thought of that before. This is like a therapy session.
I have a person dear in my life who suffers from OCD, and it has been instrumental. It has been helpful to learn more about it and to learn how, yes, it is debilitating. It can be debilitating. But it is who this person is.
Yeah.
And this person is wonderful.
And you're worthy of love.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's maybe the only thing we're worthy of, but like, you're worthy of love is exactly as who you are. And so the fact that this is who you are and this is part of who you are means that this is also worthy of love.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. I've never had that before. That's such a gift to me. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for talking about it. Okay. Three more. One, two, or three.
How about two?
What's a lesson you keep learning again and again?
Oh, what a great question. I keep learning again and again that hope is the right response to the human condition. And I have to learn this over and over again because despair is an incredibly powerful force in my life, mm-hmm, and something that I have to battle on an almost daily basis. So much of my brain tells me that there's no reason to get out of bed or do anything because nothing matters, because the oceans are going to boil in a billion years, because the world is going to end long before that for me and for everyone I love and probably for humanity itself. And people are so monstrous and capable of such horrific behavior toward each other and toward the world. And that despair is so powerful because it tells this complete holistic story. It explains everything. Everything is the way it is because everything and everyone sucks. What an incredibly powerful way to look at the world.
Yeah.
It just happens to not be true, right? Like, it happens to be a lot more complicated than that. The truth is much more complex than that. And so I have to remind myself of that almost every day. I have to relearn that lesson that, like, there is cause for hope. I actually, I keep in my wallet a little note that says, the year you graduated from high school, 12 million children died under the age of 5. Last year, fewer than 5 million did. That progress, which is real and which is felt in the lives of millions of human beings and the tens of millions who love them, that progress was not natural. It was not inevitable. It did not happen because it was always going to happen. It happened because millions and millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, maybe billions of people, came together to make it happen, to make the world safer for children. We decided that we were going to prioritize that. And when we prioritized it, we had tremendous success. And I keep that because I want to remind myself that this is the truth. Like, that is an inalienable truth, that we can make the world better for the most vulnerable among us. We just have to decide it's a priority. And so there is cause for hope. There's always reason for hope because we have this incredible capacity to collaborate together, to make the world better together. And yet, at the same time, we also have the capacity to make the world worse together. And it is so much easier to destroy progress than it is to build it. As we have lately found out, it is so much easier to destroy institutions than it is to build or maintain them. And And I have to hold those competing ideas in my mind at the same time, which is the hardest thing in the world for me, but also kind of the most important.
John Green, his newest book is called Everything is Tuberculosis. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can watch a video of Rachel's full conversation with John Green by searching for Wildcard with Rachel Martin on Spotify or YouTube. Deep in a coal mine in Vietnam are two lovers. One carries the other on his back in complete darkness. That is the opening scene of the feature film Vietnam, written and directed by Chung Ming-hui. The film debuted at Cannes Film Festival last year, though it was banned in Hui's home country of Vietnam. Set in 2001, the film follows the lovers' quest to find the body of Nam's father and their decision to leave Vietnam for a better life. In this scene, they contemplate making a break for it at the border. Tung Ming-hui, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
Both these miners are incredibly poor, and one of them wants to smuggle himself out of Vietnam. And I understand that one of the points of reference for your film was an actual event. Back in 2019 in Essex, England, 39 Vietnamese migrants were found dead in a refrigerated truck. It was part of a smuggling trip that went tragically wrong. What part of that event did you want to explore in your film?
Yeah, every time I talk about this event, mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult for me. Let me try how to say. So yeah, during the winter 2019, mm-hmm. yeah, I was living near the border of Belgium and France. And actually that place is well very close to where these people got on the truck that later arrived in the UK.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah, so I was very saddened and actually very perplexed because, you know, all of this was happening so close to me. So this event, it really made me question me and my condition as a Vietnamese who is temporary resident in Europe. And I think I felt the need to do something, to do a film on the question of home and exile.
On home and exile, yeah.
So we can say that this event is a strong emotional starting point, but the film Vietnam is not an adaptation, or the film is not trying to tell the story of that event.
No, that event created an emotional place within you from which you explored and made this movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, some of the most stunning moments in your film certainly happen at sea, but also happen underground in the coal mines. I've mm-hmm. never seen shots like this. There's the shot of the miners descending hundreds of feet with their flashlights in the elevator. There's the scene, and this is in a lot of the promo material, of the lovers laid out on a bed of coal that's twinkling almost like stars. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. What kinds of shooting challenges did the coal mine scenes pose? Can you tell one story from a moment on set?
So that elevator scene you mentioned, it's real. It happens like that. It's every day in that coal mine in the north of Vietnam.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Every day people are going down that elevator.
Yeah,
to mine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For the underground part, we couldn't shoot in the real underground coal mine.
Oh,
because because it's super dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to set up a coal mine inside a real cave, actually. And that cave, I remember.
You fabricated your own coal mine in a cave.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
In a volcanic cave.
A volcanic cave.
Yeah.
The commitment to filmmaking. Yeah.
Volcanic cave, they have the tunnel very long, you know?
Yeah.
And somehow it look man-made. It look artificial, even though it's totally natural.
And you were saying, I remember. What do you remember?
So I remember, yes, this cave had a lot of bats, you know?
So, a lot of bats?
Yes. Thousands.
And there's no bats in a mine.
No. So yeah, so we have to also deal with that. So, but
wow,
it sounds funny, but it was difficult back then. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Vietnam, this film debuted at the Cannes Film Festival last year. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. And it is also currently banned in Vietnam, in the country where you're from. What is your understanding of why? And how do you feel about that?
I think now I am somehow recovered from that. But
recovered from the banning news?
Yeah. From the that.
Okay.
But I think when that just happened, May last year, just shortly before the film premiered in uh-huh. Cannes,
mm-hmm.
I think that was very heavy for me because this was the first time I have a film banned, and I didn't know how to process this, you know. And then, of course, the public opinion in Vietnam at that time, they didn't see the film, so there were many misunderstandings, and basically that was a very chaotic time for me. My understanding that the reason why they banned my film is because they said the film was very dark, very negative.
Negative,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, which I don't think like that.
I mean, now that the movie is starting to appear in select theaters, what do you wish the Vietnamese government would see in the film? What do you wish they understood about it?
I think I wish that they could see the film with an innocent eye so that they could feel the emotions, the beauty of the landscape, of the people, you know, that capture in the film. And every time I screen the film outside of Vietnam, for example, in France,
mm-hmm.
many audience, Vietnamese overseas, they came to me after watching the film. I remember there was this old lady, and she said that, thank you for making this film that speaks her heart of 70 years old. And the film made her feel homesick. Yeah, that for me was very moved, and that's what I really hope people could get from watching the film.
Well, Tung Minh Nguy, it has been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you.
His film, Vietnam, is in select theaters now. And we did reach out to the Vietnam Cinema Department for comment about why the film was banned there, but they did not reply to our request. For Sunday, that is All Things Considered. I'm Emily Kwong. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next weekend for an awesome show with NPR's Asma Khalid. Until next time, have a great night, and we'll talk soon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.